All right. Thank you, Sherry. And again, I want to remind you, we have an Ask It Basket in the question. Please don't be shy. There are cards back there and pens. And after our next presenter, we will present those questions to all four panelists. So that'll be a great time to ask questions as well. Next up, I'd like to introduce you to a young guy who came all the way from Fresno to share today. He's somebody that I've met recently, and I happen to be quite a fan. I hope you will, too. Please offer a very warm welcome for my friend. Has that ever happened to you?
It's Rob. Cool, thank you.
How's it going? I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for having me here today. I'm like super nervous. I'd love to say that like my ego was like small enough that I didn't get nervous when I talked, but I always get nervous when I talk. If you guys don't mind, I'm just going to pray a prayer real quick, if that's cool. God, please help us to set aside everything we think we know for an open mind and a new experience. Please allow us to see the truth about step two, coming to a belief in a power greater than ourselves, and about the failure of our attempt to live our life on our own self-will. Please help us to see the truth about you. Amen. All right, so when I got here, I thought like I tried the God thing and the God thing didn't work for me. I went to church when I was younger, at about 17, of course, for a girl. And you know, I did it for a while, and I really enjoyed church, and church was great, but I think that I never really got the idea that, like, God was in control, and God was the director, and, you know, I just kind of took a mentality of me trying to do things hard and applied that to church, and when I didn't get what I wanted, then I kind of went my own way. And so I went my own way, and my way didn't work out too well for me. Just to give you a little bit about my background, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous after my third DUI. I say that not because DUI is necessary for you to be an alcoholic, but if you have several, it might be a good indicator. I had five other experiences of me drinking, driving, and police, where like the police were on the scene, and I somehow managed to finagle my way out of it. Some of my other drinking career resume stats are like, I got deported from Canada, I've had my nose broken several times, I got gravel in my face, like right here, from getting hit in the head with a 2x4 and passing out, you know, on the street, and I always seemed to like find myself in like 5-on-2 situations, and I was always on the 2 side. I have an idea like what that's about now, but I didn't at the time. So, you know, when I got here, I thought I tried the God thing. I thought the God thing didn't work for me. I was like, I need to do something different. Clearly, things are not working too well for me. I thought my life was unmanageable because I was riding my bicycle around. I'm like 31 years old, and I'm riding my bicycle back and forth to work, and I know that something's not right about that. I'm in a lot of fear that I'm going to lose my job. And I've already spent a year on my mom's couch in the trailer park at 28, and I really don't want to go back there. And, you know, that's basically what I'm looking at. And so then my lawyer suggests I start going to meetings, so I start going to meetings, and, you know, I'm pretty much willing to do whatever. And this guy comes up to me, and he asks me, he says, you know, would you, you know, like to go through the book? And to be honest, I was in my first 30 days. If he'd asked me if I wanted a sponsor, I'd have probably said no, because that would have been just, like, too much work for me. That would have been too committal. That would have been like, you know, because I was scared. And for some reason, he could pick up on that. And I know some people have that attitude that, no, you need to make people ask to be your sponsor. And I think that that's a good step. But I feel very fortunate that my sponsor didn't do that with me, and that he reached out his hand and said, hey, you want to just get together and read the book? And then he let my willingness come be demonstrated by the fact that I was, like, willing to show up there. And so I did that, and he started taking me through this book, and he said, you know, we got into my past, and he began to realize that I didn't start the timer. Okay. Okay, so he began to realize that might have been convenient. Okay, so I started to realize I had some old ideas about God, and someone suggested to me, he's like, whatever you thought about, you knew about God, didn't work out so well. Otherwise, and I'm not going to say anything new here. This is going to be hopefully stuff that you've heard in other places or in another different way. I don't try to be original about stuff. It's just my experience, and it mirrors a lot of yours if you're in the right place. It wasn't working out too well for me. Whatever I thought that I knew about God, clearly it wasn't working out for me, or I wouldn't have been in the position that I was in. I wouldn't have been riding around on my bicycle. I wouldn't have been in imminent fear that I was going to lose my job. I wouldn't have 10 years of drama, basically, because I didn't really start drinking until after I was 21. I went to college, and I largely didn't drink while I was down there because I couldn't call home for $100 when I was in college. And I didn't start drinking until after I was 21 because I had a vague notion that maybe me and alcohol wasn't a good idea. I drank a handful of times in high school, and it wasn't my experience that, I wasn't like the kind of guy that, came out of the womb with a Budweiser in his hand and drank till he blacked out like every single time. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not an alcoholic. It means I just have a phenomenon of craving, I think, in a different way. And my phenomenon of craving develops over a period of time. And towards the end, it was a lot worse than it was at the beginning. When I got here, my sponsor said, clearly what you think you know about God isn't working out for you too well, or you wouldn't be in the position that you're in. And that was very important for me to understand because I really thought that I knew a lot about God. I thought that I had been to church before, and I thought I had all these ideas, and my sponsor said something that he says to me all the time is, well, how well is that working out for you? And that gets me to a point of willingness to be able to be open-minded and to listen to other people. And so one of the things that my sponsor helped me to see about how well things were working out for me, if you could pass out, Ryan, that unmanageability exercise. And I'm not going to review this in real thorough depth, but it's basically it helps you to go over what your unmanageability is, and it's based off of page 52 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically it says the following, and I'm going to say something I heard somebody else say, and I'm going to read it from the book, although I could probably quote it because in my experience sometimes people who quote it get drunk. And that's not original either. Okay, so it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Check. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Check. We were prey to misery and depression. Check. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Which back then was the future, so you could just replace future with newsreels of lunar flight. Was it not a basic solution to these problems more important than whether we should see the future? Of course it was. So that unmanageability exercise, basically the point is to help somebody see how things aren't working out for them. And I'm not going to go into it real thorough right here, but basically what I want guys to do is to just, when I'm working with a guy, I want him to see that things aren't working out too well for him, or he wouldn't be in this position. Because my experience is, we come in here, we're real desperate, we're real willing to do something, and then we get a little bit of time, and then we start thinking, well, maybe I got this, maybe I'm cool, maybe this isn't so bad, maybe I don't have to maybe I don't have to do the rest of this stuff, maybe the rest of this stuff is extra credit. Right? If it's extra credit, I don't need to do extra credit, right? I just want to do the bare minimum necessary to get by, right? That's how I've been living my life, and that is not going to change when I got here, right? So I want guys to basically be real aware how things are not working out for them. So later on, when we're going through the steps and they're balking on something, and I'm like, well, you're not right in your fourth step, well, maybe we need to go back and review that unmanageability exercise and see how well things are working out for you. Because clearly, at any point, if you're not doing the next step, my sponsor always told me that you're not clear on your first step. You think this is optional. And there are a million different ways to do these steps, and I'm not going to claim that the way that I've done them is any better than the way anybody else has done them. And I really hate that when people do that. There's a lot of different ways to do these steps. I really related particularly a lot to what Sherry said. My experience is very similar to that. And this is just some ways, some questions that I have found useful to like work with guys, and it's not the only way to do it, and it's just a way to do it. And I think that it's based on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they write down, basically how they're experiencing these eight forms of inner unmanageability, right? And then what I want them to understand is that this question, this is kind of like unmanageability is the second part of the first step. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless because of the phenomenon of craving. First drink gets you drunk. I'm powerless because of the mental obsession, the idea that I can control and enjoy my drinking. And I'm powerless over alcohol because of my selfishness and self-centeredness, the spiritual malady that leads me back to some stuff. And we're going to talk about that. So at the bottom of this, after they see how well things are not going for them in their life, I want them to see mainly that this unmanageability from this stuff, it comes from inside them, and it's not outside them. Like, I thought my unmanageability, my life's unmanageable. I got step one down, no problem. I got it down. I can't be on step one of anything. If you're like me, I never read the preface to a book. I never read the table of contents. If it's a 12-step process, a good friend of mine says, I got to be a third of the way through. I'm on the third of the way through the steps already, right? I can't be on step one of anything, right? So, what I begin to see here is that what the second part of the first step is that our lives have become unmanageable, and this is my unmanageability, and it's inside of me, and it comes from inside of me, and it manifests itself outside of my life through circumstances and events like DUIs and broken noses and messed up families and ex-wives and children and all this other stuff, right? So that's like step one. At the bottom of this thing, I want them to think about this question, which is from step two, which is God is either everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that question is going to continue to get answered like over and over and over again. But at the bottom of page 52, it talks about the answer to these, right after this, the answer to these problems is on the next thing. It says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. So see, when I look at this, I see my ideas not working out so well. So maybe then I can get open-minded about something else working for people. And I see that in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a bunch of other people that this God idea has worked for. So I start to think, well, okay, maybe if this thing is working for them, maybe it can work for me. And the rest of these steps are based on just turning statements from the book into questions. And if you have a book or if you don't, there's very specific directions about how to read the big book. And it says at the bottom of the preface, and like I said, I never read a preface, but in the preface it says, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories, or the rest of the book for that matter, and think, yes, that happened to me. So the question is, has that happened to me? More important, yes, I felt like that, so have I felt like that? And more important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. So I just take statements from in this book and I turn them into questions. And so this next exercise from step two is basically trying to do that. And it's very similar to what she described in trying to take your old God and put it on the shelf. Someone said, obviously your idea about God ain't working out, so you need to put that on the shelf and try and come at this with an open mind and develop another conception of God. Right? And Bill talks about in Bill's story how Abby tells him, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And so that's basically what this stuff is trying to do. It's kind of what Sherry described, and it's what I'm trying to describe here. So what we do in this Appendix 2, if you could pass out the Appendix 2 thing, getting conception of God, basically there's some worksheets here, and the thing that she said about trying to ask people who you don't like, I got this particular worksheet from someone who I didn't like very much. And and it wasn't my sponsor, okay? And I should have stated this at the beginning, but my sobriety date is March 12th, 2008. You know, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that time. Now, I don't say that because it really matters, but I say it because when I was new or at different times, I wanted to know how much sobriety someone had. So in this getting a conception of a higher power thing, I got this via somebody else that I like was a friend of a friend that I'm involved with Fresno County Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous.
Everybody's got a different hang-up. If you're young, you're like, I'm too young to do this. If you're old, you're like, well, I've been doing this my whole life, right? So why stop now? Let's just go on to the bitter end, right? And the reality is we all have different hang-ups. And my hang-up was, well, I'm too young maybe to do this. I got here when I'm 31. And being involved in young people's in AA helped me to basically, it helped me to, like, remove the reservation from the table that I'm too young to do this. Because there's other young people, and they're doing it. And I thought, well, I'm ahead of the curve. I got longer. Maybe I got another run in me, this, that, the other thing. Well, there's people in there, and I'm talking to these women in this program that are like 5 and 10 years younger than me, and I'm like, clearly this woman is like way more mature than me, and not in just a regular sense, but like just way more mature than me. And I'm like, they're younger than me, maybe I'm behind the curve. I need to get my act together. You know what I mean? And so being involved in young people's helped me, and that's how I came across this, just kind of how I got open-minded enough to like actually see this getting a conception of God. So in this worksheet, the four things at the beginning talks about it. And I'm not going to go through every question on here, don't worry. But we're going to talk about a few of them. Unless you want to, you know, I'm just saying. So we find out what ideas of God we have and what we don't have, where they come from and how long we have them. We will do a set-aside prayer in which the wording is optional. I prayed a set-aside prayer at the beginning. The main point about the set-aside prayer is basically that we don't know and God needs to show us, you know? And then we will ask in that prayer what the spiritual terms in the big book and our own preferable spiritual terms mean to us. We will make a commitment of our willingness to believe. So basically, we talk about some of the questions here about what is it about the mention of God in spiritual matters that gives me feelings of discouragement or even hopelessness. For me, my own personal experience with that is, well, I've been to church. I tried it. Didn't work for me. Clearly, I wouldn't be in this situation. So that's what my answer to that question is. And I can elaborate on that some more, but I'm going to move through it. When and from whom did I get these ideas? Well, I got it from a bunch of people that I was growing up with, right? And I got it from going to church when I was like 17 through 21. What subjects about God have I evaded or entirely ignored? Well, there's a long list. I won't get into that. When and from whom, you know, did I get these ideas? Kind of that's the same question there. What are my honest doubts and prejudices about God? Well, I'm not even sure if God's there. You know, I don't know if God is going to, and if he is there, he hasn't gotten me out of the rest of this nonsense. So maybe he's not going to help me. Right? What have I been anti-religious about? And I just talked about that. Like, well, I went to church and it didn't work for me. When I don't like, and I particularly don't like holier-than-thou people. And what are some ideas about God which have been impressed upon me about childhood? And we go through that, right? So these are some questions that come from page 45 and 46, right? And then the bottom of this worksheet, it says, do I see that it's imperative that all these old ideas and beliefs about God be laid aside if I need to establish a conscious contact with God in order to live a sober and useful life? Do I understand that if I have these old ideas about God, and that if this program says, this whole program, the big book says the main object of the book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself. If I have old ideas about God and those ideas aren't working, and I can't get rid of those old ideas, and I have to get in touch with a power greater than myself, I'm kind of screwed, right? So I basically need to like set aside those old ideas if they aren't working for me. And that's kind of what this question is talking about. So that I got to see that I got to set aside some of that stuff. On the next page it says, do I see if there's any old ideas or beliefs I'm not willing to lay aside? It's an indication of my lack of clarity in step one. Like, I might think this is optional. I might think this is extra credit. I might think I don't have to do this. And you don't have to do it this way. You can do it a million different ways. There's a lot of different ways to do it. But I do believe that if you have old ideas about God that aren't working, and you are hanging on to those old ideas, and you need to get in touch with God, and those old ideas are blocking you, you need to let go of those old ideas or you're in big trouble. Right? So this exercise is kind of one way to do that. So I trusted in saying the set-aside prayer that God will help, will wipe me clean in that instant. In the beginning, I don't really trust it. I'm hoping that it will, but I'm not really sure. Do I see that I have an old idea that I'm not willing to lay aside, or don't trust that God will wipe clean instantly, then I should not go further on until I'm clear on those principles. Now, I don't know that I necessarily completely agree with that. This is written by somebody else, but like I got something out of this, and I don't know that I necessarily totally agree with that. I went on in the beginning without being totally clear on that.
Do I believe the unwillingness to accept these principles has anything to do with whether I'll drink alcohol again or not? Absolutely I do, because all the rest of these people tell me that they got to get in touch with a higher power, and I realize that if that's blocking me, then I can see that, right? And then I'll pray the set-aside prayer. And the set-aside prayer can be said in a number of different ways, especially if I'm going into a meeting and I'm like, oh, that guy's talking again. I don't want to listen to that guy. I've heard that guy 500 times. I know what he's going to say down to the line and verse and everything, right? And I'm like, God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about this meeting for an open-minded and new experience. Please allow me to see the truth, you know? And that helps to give me a little bit humble and, you know, to do that, right? And God basically, I believe, gives me power in that to do that. So the next thing is basically trying to define our own conception of God. The same thing Sherry was talking about with basically trying to come up with her new idea of God. This is what this is doing. And it's basically taking capitalized terms. There's capitalized terms all throughout the big book. Like spirit of the universe, creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature, czar of the heavens, creator, friend, father of life, heaven, higher power. All these different spiritual terms, you're going to basically say, God, what do you, you're going to take a pen and paper, God, what do you as spirit of the universe honestly mean to me, right? And so, like, I'm going to show you, like, example, what my particular idea is doesn't really matter, right? But, so you get an idea of, like, what I'm talking about, spirit of the universe, the timeless entity that was before the universe and will be here after. That's my idea of what spirit of the universe means to me. And then I'll say, God, what do you as universal mind mean to me? The synergy that affects different people at different times to have the same thought or common purpose, which causes the myriad of coincidences to occur together in a meaningful and purposeful way. Right? Creator, maker. God, what do you as creator or maker honestly mean to me? The entity which brought me and all life and not life into existence from nothingness that existed previously. The thing which knows best how for me to live and exist and to design me. God, what do you as friend honestly mean to me? Has my back, not judgmental, disdainful, looking out for my best interests, feelings, just sincere desire to be helpful, not trying to manipulate me to its own desires and wants what is best for me, not keeping track of credits and debits. And one of the old ideas that I had about God was up there with like a little black general ledger book, my credit and debit, right? And a lot of things on there on my debits and not so many on my credits. And then eventually, like, my debits, like, mounted up to the point where I'm like, well, I'm screwed anyways. And I used to say this all the time when I was drinking. Might as well pour a little gas on the fire, right? I mean, in for a penny, in for a kilo, we might as well pour a little gas on the fire. If I'm going to hell, let's have a good time, right? So that's an old idea for me that, like, doesn't work. And I got to let go of this idea that, you know, God's got this little general ledger book up there and he's keeping track of all this stuff. And one of the things that helped me to let go of that was, like, someone said to me, hey, imagine if you have a puppy, right, and the puppy pees on, and this is real simple, but I got to hear it because I was being open-minded. They said, you know, if you have a puppy and it pees on your floor, are you mad at the puppy? And I'm like, not particularly. I'm like, that's what puppies do. You just clean it up, you try and train them, whatever the deal is, but I'm not mad at the puppy. No. And they're like, so do you want the puppy to do that? No, you don't want the puppy to do that. Right? But if you're not mad at the puppy, and you still love the puppy, right? How much more do you think the omnipotent creator of the universe that created you and knows everything about you, your ins and outs, your good and your bad, how much more does he love you than that puppy? Do you think he's really mad at you? He knows everything that's going on. He's not mad at you. He loves you. Right? So, I mean, that gets me emotional. So, basically, the next thing is, do I see that my answers come from inside me and not any outside source? Right? When I see that, when I see that, my answers come from inside of me, not from any outside source. That's my own conception of God, right? So then, the third page here, do I believe that I can commence spiritual growth and affect my first conscious relation with God as he now wants me to understand him? Do I see that I receive my answers in prayer to spiritual terms that I never heard of or would have considered prior to the set-aside prayer? Do I see that having this experience is spiritual growth in itself. Just being willing to sit down with a pen and paper and do this and be like, this is hokey. I can't believe this. This is supposed to change my life. Like, really? Like, I don't buy that when I do this, right? But I'm like, if I've done a real clear, thorough first step, I realize, like, I don't have any other options, man. I don't have any other options. So why not sit down? And the first time I did this sort of stuff, I did it just because I was like, well, I want to know that I gave this thing the full shot. I want to know that I tried this, not like every other thing that I half-assed in my life, not like every other thing that I tried to come in with the minimum amount of effort and the lowest common denominator and never worked out. I want to believe that I don't believe even that this is going to work for me in the beginning, but I want to know that when I get to the end of this and it doesn't work, that I gave it the full shot. And so that's why I got willing to sit down with a little spiral notebook and a piece of paper and spend 2 hours on some worksheets from some crazy dude that I was like, this can't possibly work. Right? And it's not my stuff. This is stuff from the book. This is some stuff that helps to like lend clarity to it for me. Do I trust that these conceptions of God that I've been given are enough for a spiritual structure to begin to grow in me? Do I now, having done this exercise, believe, or am I even willing to believe? And this is the cornerstone question from page 47. Do I now, having done this exercise, believe, or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself that wants to demonstrate and have a particular conception of him that will take me beyond my bedevilment, all that unmanageability we wrote about in the first exercise, and anything I've experienced up to the present? And if I do that, and I start to have, I still have, when I read this stuff, I still get emotional. I begin to get willing to believe to do that. Right? So then, what that is it's just doing the same thing that Eddie did with Bill, that Sherry was talking about. Setting aside your old ideas about God, and being willing to develop some new ones. And this is one way to do that. And there's a number of different ways. The way that the exercise that she did is another way to do it. Right? Okay, another way that I've heard about doing it is people say, okay, what's your idea of God? And then they say, now imagine if that God had a God. What would that God's God look like? And basically, I know for people that that's worked really well, because we have a tendency to project a lot of human characteristics on God. And then we try and imagine what that God's God would look like. And then we realize, oh, I'm projecting all this human stuff onto God, and God's really not got any of that human stuff. I heard someone say in a meeting earlier this week that the number of stars in the universe are, there's more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on the planet. I can't wrap my head around that. I don't really know what that means. Like the size of that, the enormity. Like if God's that big, like it completely changes my whole perception of things. So getting into like step three. So when I'm working with someone, though, the main question that I want them to answer from we agnostics from step two is, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? Am I willing to do that? And I was willing to believe in the beginning, and then that's where I proceeded from. So step three takes us into the next worksheet. I'm going to pass this out. And all it does is, another thing that I've used is something called Big Book Awakening. And if you go to like jaywalker.com, which if you're familiar with the Jay Walker story for more about alcoholism, repeating the same behavior and expecting different results is what that website is. And you go to Big Book Awakening, you search for Big Book Awakening on Google and you'll find it. And you send away a few bucks and they send you this booklet. And it talks about how to ask yourself these questions, okay? So I've written out some of these questions here, and it's from that, and I feel that I should basically acknowledge that to some degree. But my sponsor was doing the same thing with me, just turning statements into questions. When I work with somebody going through the steps, we sit down. I know some sponsors, how my sponsor did it with me originally was, we sat down, and he read from me, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many hundreds of men and women have recovered. But we read from right there all the way through, and we read it line by line, and he would turn the statements into questions as we were doing it. So that by the time I get to the fourth step, I've already told him all my stuff. We've already went over it, because he's already asking all these questions. It ain't no big deal for me to tell him something in 4 and 5 when I've already been sitting there for 10 hours telling him my whole life story. Right? So that I believe that works like well, and I do that with the guys. So we sit down and we read through, you know, these pages, right? So if you had your book, you would see that these basically are straight from pages 58 through 63 of the big book. And we hear like how it works, you know. So we'll pray the set aside prayer. God, please enable me to set aside everything I think I know for open mind and new experience. Please enable me to see the truth about the failure of my life run on self-will and my decision to turn my will and my life over the care of you, God. In a spiral notebook with the other step work on a separate piece of paper, I try and encourage guys to get basically a spiral notebook with a couple of binders in it so they can put some loose paperwork in there. And just, this is it. It ain't complicated. You don't got to be like a super bookworm. But, I mean, it might just save your life. You know what I mean? And I encourage you to do that. And later on, my experience is you got to give this stuff away to keep it. And you might not be thinking about it now. And you might think, I'm never going to do that. But you're really going to want that later on when you're trying to take some dude through step one. And you're like, oh, what did I do? I don't know. I can't remember. And I haven't sponsored a ton of guys. I've sponsored about 10 guys. I'm working with about 4 guys right now. And several of those guys have not stayed sober. And the guys that I'm working with right now seem to be sober. And I don't understand why that is and why that's not. And that's just like left up to God, and it's not for me to understand. So I say that because I'm not trying to sound like I know how to do this. It's just the way that I've done it. Okay, so have I rarely seen a person fail who is thoroughly, that word thoroughly bolded, follow the path outlined in the 12 steps of the big book? Do I believe those who don't recover are those who won't completely give themselves to the simple program? Do I understand the 12-step process demands rigorous honesty? All stuff from how it works. And you could just, and some of these are kind of like, yes, but I need you to know when you're writing these out and you write, and you actually write the question out and you write yes, there's something that goes on in my head when I write a question out versus when I read it. So when I write it out and then I write yes, I understand, like, it helps me to understand, so I do that with the guys I work with. Do I have the capacity to be honest? You know, have I decided I want what they recovered alcoholics have? What is it that they want? And the questions here in bold are the ones that I'm going to just kind of focus on. Am I willing to go to any length as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to get these things? The next thing I want them to be clear on when they get to the third step is, how does the book define an alcoholic? And I believe the best definition in the big book is from page 44, and I'm looking for two things, and that's if when we honestly want to quit, we find we cannot, and that's because of the mental obsession. And if when drinking, do I lose control over the amount that I take, and that's because of the phenomenon of craving. And I want guys to understand the knowledge. That is what makes someone an alcoholic, okay? That's what the big book says anyways. And then what's your experience with those two things? And your experience may be different. You may be one of these guys that basically has been a blackout drinker since you were 3 years old. Or you might be like me and never taken a drink until you're 21 and then later grew into it. Right? So, or not never taken a drink. I took a drink before I was 21, but that didn't really kick off until after I was 21. So, am I an alcoholic? Do I have the two requirements the book uses to describe an alcoholic? This is going to be the ABCs here. And in the original manuscript, it said, if you're not convinced of these things, go back and review or throw the book away. Like, you've got to be convinced of this stuff. I believe, you know what I mean? Am I an alcoholic? I'm sorry if I get passionate. I'm not going to say you have to do it this way. I get passionate about this when I'm talking with guys about it. Am I an alcoholic? So can I manage my own life? And then they start to think that they can, we review the bedevilment. We review that first exercise. Nah, you wasn't working out so well for you, right? So you're real clear that you can't manage your own life. Can any human power relieve my alcoholism? This is straight from the ABCs. Do I think that God can and will if I seek Him? And then basically, I got 1 minute left. And I know I started late. Sorry. So am I convinced that my life run on my self-will cannot be a success? And from my experience, I'm kind of convinced of that, right? 10 years and all my personal experience, I'm convinced of that. But then I want people to understand, particularly, the stuff that is talked about on the next page. So if you go to the next page, question 43. Am I beginning to see that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem? And I thought that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my problem because I thought this was about them trying to make me into a better Boy Scout. I thought this was optional when I got here. I thought, yeah, I got to not drink, but I'm just going to be unselfish martyr for the rest of my life, Mother Teresa? That's not going to happen, right? So, but I need to see that, I need to understand this, the thing that it talks about that's written here. Do I understand, on the question on 47, do I understand how my selfishness can lead to a sequence of dominoes that can end in my death? So, do I understand how my selfishness can lead to a sequence of dominoes which can end in my death? And do I understand this sequence of dominoes, specifically from reviewing the first 58 or so pages of the Big Book, that my spiritual malady, my self-will, my selfishness and self-centeredness brings me to the inner unmanageability on page 52? Okay? That brings me to all the stuff that they reviewed in the first exercise. And when I'm in the middle of that stuff, my mind doesn't tell me, well, let's take it easy. Well, you're on thin ice, buddy. My mind says, I want a sense of ease and comfort to resolve this inner feeling stuff. Right? And I know how to fix this right now. We can fix this right now. And that is when the insanity of alcohol returns for me, right? And that takes me, if I sit in that insanity of alcohol, and the insanity of alcohol is that I can control and enjoy my drinking. I don't believe it's the obsession that I'm going to drink. I believe it's the obsession that I can control how bad it's going to get. Well, I'll just pick up another sobriety date. That's all that'll happen. I won't go to jail. I won't lose my wife. I won't lose my kids. I won't lose my job. I'll just pick up a new sobriety date. No big deal, right? If I'm a real alcoholic and I have not been able to control and enjoy my drinking in the past, the insanity is not that I want to drink. The insanity is that I think I can control how bad it's going to get. I may even, it's my belief, I may even like admit that like some bad's going to happen. But I think that I control what level it's going to go to, right? And so if I sit in that long enough, that mental obsession, the idea that from page 30 that somehow someday I'll control and enjoy my drinking, that can take me to the first drink, which if I'm a real alcoholic, the phenomenon of craving then kicks in. The first drink gets you drunk. One is too many and 1,000 is not enough. And I'm off to the races and I can go through the fatally progressive stages of alcoholism. Category 1, 2, 3, and 4 from 2Y on those pages, and that ultimately ends in death. So now I start to see me being unselfish is not just about me being a better Boy Scout. It's not just about extra credit. My selfishness actually leads me to problems with personal relationships and all this inner unmanageability and all this stuff on page 52. 52 takes me to page 30. Page 30, which is the mental obsession, I can control and enjoy it. That takes me to the first drink, and I'm off to the race. Okay, and I'm going to wind down with basically the last things that I want them to do in step 3 is define the director-actor relationship. Okay, what does that relationship look like? Have I failed at directing my own life on my own power? Define the principal-agent relationship. Am I ready to be what God would have me be? Define the father-child relationship. Define the employer-employee relationship. Am I ready to make a decision that God will provide what I need if we keep close to Him and perform His work well? And these are the things from the Big Book that are really important to me, the keystone requirements. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. So I get convinced that me doing it my way don't work, based on my experience and also based on understanding that sequence of dominoes. Then I begin to understand that I have to quit playing God. Okay? And there's some other questions in here that will help you to do that. And then we decide that hereafter in life that God is going to be our director, principal, father, employer. We think well before taking a step, am I ready to abandon myself utterly to God? Then I start to ask them, are you ready to complete a course of vigorous action? And I've heard this over and over again. If 3 frogs are sitting on a log and one makes a decision to jump off, how many frogs are still on the log? 3. Nobody did anything. Right? So we're going to follow this up with a course of vigorous action, right, in the 4th step. And then I ask them to memorize the 3rd step prayer and review these answers with me. So that is kind of like what we do, what I do there. And there's a number of different ways to do it, and there's a number of different books to do it. I want to thank Bill for the opportunity to come here, and thank you for hearing me out. And God bless you.
Turn the timer off.
Hey, I'm excited because this is last month.
this was a really exciting portion of our show, so I hope you enjoy this as much as I expect I will. I want to thank all four of our panelists for coming here and sharing their experience. And we're going to head out, and we're going to take questions that we've compiled from the question and answer box basket back there. And so I'll ask a question, and then we'll pass the mic for those answers. So the first question we have is, my sponsor told me she could provide direction but not motivation. Have you found this to be true in your experience?
So, or what do we do? Each one person answer, or
each of you just go.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, my experience is that, like, I can't give anybody motivation. I just try and help to point them at some questions that basically they might see that things aren't working out for them. And like, you can't give anybody motivation. I've learned that. One type of thing we do to help me understand that people are like willing to do is I have guys come and meet me at my house versus going to pick them up. Like, because when I was going to pick them up, if you're willing to make it to my house, you know what I mean, that sort of thing, that tells me that you're willing to do some stuff. And I believe God's got to give you the motivation. And if you don't have the willingness to do this, ask God to give you the willingness. God, please help me to have the willingness to do this. I want to be willing to willing, but I'm not. And so pray for willingness is what I suggest for people who don't have motivation. And try to look back at your life and see how well what you've been doing is working for you. And pray for willingness and to see the truth.
That's right. I totally agree with what he just said. I'm always really good about being a cheerleader for my girls. Is I always say, come on, we'll do this together. If you want, we can sit down and answer the questions together. You know, this is only for your benefit. I'm just reminding you that steps only heal what you're willing to heal. So, you know, that's what I always say is you have to be your own motivator. But for me, I always try to motivate my girls also is reminding them that, you know, in working steps, they get to be better people. And most girls, most of us want to be better people, so.
And I agree with Rob.
Yeah.
Same.
Right.
The motivation comes from within, you know, God. I haven't sponsored anybody that hasn't come to me broken and unhappy and wanting a better life. And there's your motivation right there. Is it working for you? Do you feel good? If you want to feel better, there's a way. And the steps are the way.
Outstanding. One of the natural, well, I guess natural born gifts and talents that I think that I've been given was, and I've always used this terminology, the ability to motivate people. And it probably means more the ability to inspire people. Through my own experience and the passion that Rob obviously has, is that, I don't know, it's just something I've always been able to do is to put that off onto somebody else and try to get them to feel that fire, but the answer is no. And I think a better word is desire. I can't make you desire recovery. I can't make you want this. I can sit here and we can all sit up here and share how fantastic life is. We can't make you want it.
The next question is a little bit of a read here. I have turned my life and will over to a higher power in regards to my alcoholism, and God has not failed me in removing my obsession to drink. What advice would you give to someone who is struggling with turning their life and will over to their higher power in regards to other issues in their life? So with the exception of alcohol, I find I still want to do my will until I've exhausted all human possibilities. Well, I don't have any other issues in my life, so I'll make sure there's one right there. Do it again. Do it again. And when you wake up, you do it again. And again. And, you know, we've all heard it said that, yeah, I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it, but it has claw marks all over it. And it's not so easy for it. And I take it back, you know, and I think, because I've got this. Don't you know who I am? Yeah, come on, I got to do this. Don't you know what I do for a living and how I have? No.
No, see, I'm taking back my will when I start thinking like that. I have to do it again and again. And that's what my sponsor is for and my support group is for. Is, wow, Larry, you're really running the show today. Ooh, ouch. No, I need to do it again. Turn it over again. Practice step three again.
I want to, it's control, and I have none. You know, that's why I go. And exactly, do it again. You constantly you think, okay, if I say it this way, or if I do it this way, or if I phrase it, you know, you're trying to control. You're trying to control. It's unmanageability, you know? Stop going there. Yes, turn it over, do it again.
Wow, what a great way to say it. I just want to have a better life. So, you know, make the changes if you want to have a better life.
Yeah, I agree, and I'll say that, like, me personally, like, other than the 9-step, like, people talk a lot about the 4-step, but the 4-step, I write, it's not a big deal, it's just between me and my sponsor, it's not that big a deal. The 9-step is probably my problem, the step that I have the most problems with, and then after that step, the 3rd step. And, like, you know, it's become clear to me, even just in trying to, like, review some of this stuff again, that, like, you know, I constantly take this stuff back, like, over and over and over again. And the thing that I would say is, like, I don't fully have the answer to that other than to try and understand that this thing about the selfishness, your problem is not alcohol. Like I've heard other people say, like, alcohol is my solution to these inner problems on page 52. I got these inner problems, and alcohol is my solution to that. So, like, once you remove that, I still got this inner unmanageability stuff. And you can do that with elements exercise, like, and review your unmanageability after being around here a long time. And I have, and that's when I first did it. And so if that unmanageability is, like, untreated alcoholism, then I begin to see, okay, my selfishness and self-centeredness is my problem. So then there are specific things, like, in the rest of the steps to do. And one of the things that I would suggest that helps me to get out of myself is to basically work with another alcoholic or do something for somebody else, because then I'm not all focused on myself. And that is really hard, and I can't even do that without God's help. So if I'm not willing to do that, I say, God, please help me to help this person. I don't even really want to talk to this person right now. Help me to help this person. And so the thing about getting out of selfishness that I try and that helps me get out of selfishness is to do, but you got to do something. If you can't just, my experience is you can't just sit in it and expect it to go away. Do something and help somebody else. That helps me to get out of being selfish.
If I may, yeah. One thing I heard in this question was have the obsession to use removed. Well, that's kind of asking for the symptom of the problem to be removed instead of the problem. It's not the obsession to use as much as it is the obsession. And if you separate whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or money or food or power, you apply the same spiritual principles to whatever the symptom is, sex, money, food, drugs, alcohol, instead of asking for one thing to be removed, you ask for the obsession to be removed. And certainly, personally, I apply the steps and the principles to all areas of my life. It's that constant belief that something outside of myself is going to make me feel better about me inside myself. Okay? That truly comes from my higher power.
Okay, next question is that, do you wait to be asked to sponsor someone, or would you offer to sponsor someone who seems to be in need? Who makes the initial approach?
In my experience, there tends to be kind of an old school style and a kind of a new school style where people stand up in a room and say, hey, I'm new here and I'm looking for a sponsor. And back in the long ago, you didn't get that opportunity. Come in, sit down, shut up. You can't even open your mouth until you have 90 days. And by the way, that guy sitting next to you that you can't stand, he's going to be your sponsor. That was the old school way of doing it. I have gone up to people and said, check it out, man. You obviously need to get to work on this stuff, and you're not asking anybody. And I'm kind of feeling like God has told me that I'm your sponsor. What are you going to do, argue with God? It doesn't always work, but it has worked, okay? You know, not everybody's going to recover.
not everybody's going to do this thing. So whatever's going to work is going to work. Okay? I've seen it work both ways, actually.
I have waited for people to ask me. But I have seen people struggling and needing a sponsor, and I have led meetings on sponsorship, and we've gone through the pamphlets and the information on it, and I've talked to people about, I'm hearing in your talk you need a sponsor. You need a sponsor. But I don't say, I'll be your sponsor. I still feel that's up to them to make that step, because that's part of their recovery for me.
I agree with Larry. It works both ways for me. I have actually told girls that I'm going to sponsor them, and then I've also, I think that the key is also not just in the asking, because, I mean, you can walk up to somebody and ask if they'll sponsor you, but you need to make sure that whoever you're talking to is actually going to have time to work with you. And is it somebody you're seeing in meetings regularly? Because if you see me, and this is the first time you've seen me, and you ask me to sponsor you, where have you seen me before? How are you going to be in contact with me? How are we going to, you know, enmesh? Because for me, it's really important for me to be able to see you regularly. Sponsorship means I need to know who you are and you need to know who I am. It's about sharing intimacy into me I see. So that's something else you need to take into consideration when you're looking around the room thinking, who am I supposed to ask to sponsor me? You're supposed to get someone that is going to see you and hold you accountable.
Yeah, so like, I shared with you like what happened with me. My sponsor came up and said, hey, we want to get together and start reading the book. And so then that's what I tried to do with other guys. But when I was early sponsoring people, I feel like I messed up because I was constantly driving to them or going across town to meet them. And I was going out of my way to do this for them. And you know what? I know that these guys did plenty of things when they were drinking and using to get what it is that they needed to get. So like, you know, all I really need to do is say, hey, are you willing to read this book with me? Are you willing to do some work? And then why don't you be at my house at this time? And I try and meet with the guys once a week at a specific time, so there's no, like, question. I'm meeting, you know, like, I meet Mike at 5 o'clock on Mondays. I usually meet Ian. I usually meet Amitai on Tuesdays. I meet this guy. I meet basically Scott on Wednesday. And I meet Ian on Thursday at 5:30, right? So, like, they know that's when they're going to be there, and they got to come to my house. Now, if they don't come to my house and don't show up, what skin is that off my back? If they're not willing to do the work, then so be it. But I basically put myself out there and made it opportunity available. And I just feel like we can basically make people, like, I know there's some people like, you got to hit your bottom, you got to do this. I'm really thankful, grateful to God that man is in my life that basically allowed me to do that and saved me from getting run over for the next 10 or 15 years. So.
Yeah. In our sponsor family, we've come to the agreement that we will not take on any new sponsees until we've talked to our sponsor first. Bill is my sponsor brother. We share the same sponsor. And this doesn't mean that I'm asking my sponsor for permission for anything. Look, he's my 12-step spiritual guide. He's not my dad. He's not my boss. He's not my higher power. Although he's my soundboard, okay? I bounce the stuff off of him, and he can say, hey, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Or he can say, whoa, wait, can you hear yourself? There are many, sometimes very deeply psychologically scarred reasons for why we pick somebody up as a sponsee or ask somebody to be their sponsor without us knowing it. I once took on a young man as a sponsee because he was arrested with my son and spent time in jail with my son. And I didn't realize at the time I was trying to save my son through this guy, you know, until my sponsor pointed it out. Wow. So, you know, we always check with our sponsor for any underlying reasons, okay? It's something we think is healthy.
And second motives.
Yeah.
Can you have more than one sponsor?
Yeah, so I have one person, like, I think I hear about people saying that they do, like, all the time. My personal experience is, like, I have other people that I have, like, I call it, like, second-tier support, like, that I'm, like, close with, and I have other people that I, like, look up to in the program that I'm honest with, but, like, I do have my one main sponsor who, like, takes me through the steps. The reason that that is like, I think that there's so many different ways to do the steps, and then, you know, if you're hearing one way to do the steps over here, and one way to do the steps over here from, like, different people, it can kind of be confusing to new people, and they begin to think, oh, well, maybe I'm not doing it right, you know, and so I try to basically, if someone else has a sponsor, I might share some of my experience on a step, but I don't try and, like, inundate them with, like, how I'm necessarily doing it, and I don't want to basically have anybody think, oh, well, I'm not doing it the right way. You know, any way that you're doing the steps is any step we're taking is we're taking wrong in this guy. And so I think it's definitely doable. And I have, you know, I have people that I look up to, but I do have one person that I call sponsor and who I give up his steps to and who knows me in and out. And I consider him first tier support, knows my character defects real well.
What I was taught in the beginning is, find a sponsor that you can trust and go to them with all of your stuff. And if I got you as a sponsor and I got you as a sponsor and I share part of my stuff with you and a little bit of my stuff with you, then who really knows all of me? How are you going to be able to pull my covers if I don't share all of my deepest, darkest secrets with one person? So for me, that's the key in keeping one sponsor. And even though, you know, you heard me share that I've had more than one sponsor, I stick with one sponsor at a time, for me.
Yeah, I agree. I stick with one at a time, too. You also heard me share I've had two. But it was more because of proximity. I really think that it's better that you just stick with the one. The tiers of support are good, and that I encourage and you know, talk to anybody, but you need somebody, I feel, that really knows the whole story. Mm-hmm. So there's no secret, you know, that you're not able to kind of fudge or pull punches or whatever, you know, your sponsor knows what's what.
I like that terminology, tiers of support. Same thing, we call a sponsor family. But yeah, I do have that one unfortunate soul who has to hear my 10th step on a regular basis. But see, I'm a manipulating dope fiend, okay? And if it's called splitting, okay? If I have two sponsors and I didn't like what I hear from this one, okay? But in our sponsor family, no, we stick with the one sponsor who's going to hear all the good stuff. All right, thank you. When, if ever, do you reach a point with a non-cooperative sponsee where you say, we're done, and drop him or her? I have way too much experience with this. Personal experience with it. There's no, it's not written anywhere that I'm aware of that this is exactly when and where or how. But check it out. Sponsorship, look, guiding somebody through the 12 steps is a sponsor's primary purpose. Yeah, they're not taxi cab drivers, loan sharks, or marriage counselors, while that stuff, you know, does tend to happen because we become emotionally tied to this person we call a sponsor. But their primary purpose is to guide through the 12 steps. And if we're not working the steps, then this isn't a sponsor relationship. Let's just go back to being buds. We can go to meetings, we can go get coffee, we can hang out, you can call me anytime you want. But if we're not working the steps, then it's not a sponsor relationship. I have let people go, and I've got sponsor uncles and sponsor brothers that say, no, you never, and I don't like this word, fire a sponsor. I don't like that word either. I mean, but let's change the nature of our relationship then. If we're not working steps together, it's not a sponsorship relationship.
I agree. It's not a sponsor relationship if you're not working the steps. I've never had to fire anybody. I don't like that term either. But I have had people stop working actively, and that's what my purpose is as a sponsor. So I have been a friend, and we just gently stopped sponsoring, you know. But I've still been a friend, and that's different.
You have to call me in order to call me sponsor. That's what I was taught in the beginning, and that has really worked really well for me. And even girls that want to use me in name only, I say to them, you have to call me in order to call me sponsor. That's how sponsorship works. I can't help you if you're not willing to help yourself.
How often?
Well, in the beginning, I would tell you that every day. I would ask you to call me every day for a week at least. Let's get on a communication level where that I can communicate with you and that you feel comfortable in calling me, because if you can't call me every day in the beginning, you're not going to call me when shit happens. You can't even call me when nothing's happening. I mean, that's how it works in my life. If I'm not calling you just to form a relationship with you, then I'm not going to call you when something bad happens, because I don't feel like I can trust you. And that's what it's all about, is developing trust. That's what sponsorship is all about. I called it intimacy earlier. Into me I see. For me, that's what sponsorship is. It's allowing someone to see inside of me and to know who I am so that they feel comfortable enough and I feel comfortable enough with them. That's what it's all about. It's not, oh, tell me all your dirt so I can share it with all the other girls. That's not what sponsorship is about. Sponsorship is about having someone that you can feel the freedom to share your stuff with and know that that's where it stays. I've shared it with you, and my secret is safe with you, but it's no longer a secret. It's not a sickness for me.
Yeah, so I've definitely like struggled with this, and so I'm still relatively new to sponsoring, so I don't like completely understand it. You know, like when to do that and when not to. When you first start sponsoring, I want to believe that it's all like rule based and that the process is like uniform from one individual to the next. I really want that because it's structured and it's like controlled. It's easy for me to think that I'm in control, right? If I know like what the structure is and everything, but I'm beginning to learn that it's very not like that, and it's really intuitive, and it like depends upon the individual. You know, I've had like some guys that I basically told them, I'm like, look, I don't want you to have a false sense of security and think you're doing the deal when you're not doing the deal. If you are meeting with me once a week and we have our time to meet once a week and you aren't calling me, then you're not doing the deal. And saying that you have a sponsor, it's false. So then there's that going on, and then at the other time, I've had guys that I've considered doing that with, and I've talked with my sponsor about it, and my sponsor says he's also of the mind that you don't let them go, you just have your time, and then if they don't show up, they don't show up. And but he says, if you do that, he's like, you're just putting that problem on somebody else in AA. He's like, let them go out. Like, when they get willing, they'll come back to you, and then they'll be willing to do some stuff. And it has been my experience that people who have relapsed, like, when you have that experience as a sponsor with someone who has relapsed already, and then they, like, when they go out, because usually when they go out, guess what? They relapse. When they ain't doing the work around, if you don't do the work around here, you relapse. So, like, when they go out, and then you basically have to be, well, you're not calling me so-and-so, you're not calling me, you're not doing the work, so I just assume you relapsed. What's going on? You know what I mean? And, like, that basically makes it real clear for people to begin to understand, oh, if I don't do the work, I will relapse again. And you have had that experience with that, so you can basically point that out to them. So it's really useful sometimes not to do that. But I don't believe there's any one size fits all, and it's highly intuitive, and you have to depend on your higher power for the answer in that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, this seems kind of related. If someone who has worked through step 6, 7, or maybe even 8 or 9, who knows, and then they relapse, do you continue with the step work where they left off, or do you do something different?
Okay, so we go back to one. We go back to one. That's what my sponsor told me about. And actually, I didn't mention this in my steps, and I just say it real quick. I went through 1 through 5. My sponsor had me go through, review the 5th step promises, and I came back to him and I said, I'm not walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. I'm not feeling it. And it was largely because I didn't find my part in the 4th step. And my sponsor said, well, I guess we missed something. We better go back. And he wasn't sure what we missed. And so we just went right back to 1. And it was like a grow or go moment for me. And that's what happens. When you come back, it's a grow or go moment. Like, okay, well, you can't just, I believe you have to go back to answer the original question. You have to go back to one because you're not clear on the first step, and that's what my sponsors told me.
I agree. When you invite the manageability back into your life, you need to start over.
I'm thinking. You know, I find it very individual. A lot of the higher powers in there. I have had sponsees actually say, I'm struggling. You know, I think I need to go back. And I've agreed, you know. But a lot of times it goes back to three. And I have done that with people, you know. But, yeah, it's intuitive to the individual. And you know where they are, and usually they know where you are. And as you just talk and start, what's going on, talk it through, you're led to where you need to go. I have been.
Yeah, I believe you have to go back to number one because that's the very fundamental beginning of the 12 steps. If a person hasn't come to that understanding of his or her powerlessness, that's where you're pouring your foundation to build your recovery house on it, right? And you can't build a house without that foundation. Yeah, I believe you have to go back to one.
All right. Thank you. I'm afraid we're a little bit over time, but I'm going to ask one last question of our panelists, and then we'll close up. To turn my will and my life over to God as I understand Him, wouldn't it be safer to build a God? No. Build a God. What is that? Man-made? Built out of what? Built from my ideas? My ideas is what got me here. And I'm going to use those same ideas to develop, create, or build a power greater than myself. I'm going to stick with my original response. No.
Build a God. Well, except that I would say an understanding. A lot of times the understanding is what they're struggling with because of past experiences. I've had a lot of sponsees who've had very strict religious upbringings that are just so gun shy, they just can't even face it. And you have to let them go through and learn that no, your God doesn't have to be that. You can choose. And that's where I say.
Well, it's kind of funny. I talked about building a God. So I guess the answer is still no. It's like Larry said, it's not that I'm not building a God. If you're asking, is it safer to just build a God? Safer for who? Would be my question. Safer for who? This is a healing process for those that are willing. So, you know, for me, when I got here and what I continue to do is turn my will and my life over to, I did build it. I did build a loving, trusting relationship with a God of my understanding, the one that I got to decide what kind of God he was. But now what I do, how I act, what are my actions, that's the key. It's not what I have, it's what I do. So for me, it's now the action has to come into play. If I make the decision, what is the action? So I have to do the action. I have to trust that God's gonna, if I, you know, build it and they will come. I have to do the footwork. I have to be the one to do the footwork.
I just wanted to read this one thing. I used to have this old idea that like I had to like link up with God, like I had to get an internet connection, like God's out here in the ether somewhere, out here in the universe, and I gotta get like a connection to him. You know, like that's visually how I thought about it. And then what my sponsor pointed out to me was this thing about where we find God, and he said, actually it says on page 55, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup, just as much as we have a feeling for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. So it's not God's out here that I gotta like link up with him. I believe God's in here, inside of all of us, and like we just gotta uncover the stuff that he's there. So you don't have to build one because you already got one. He's already in there. Okay.
All right. Contributing to today's workshop. Our next workshop will be held here on the second Saturday of next month. That's March 10th. And it'll go from 9:30 till noonish. I guess is maybe the noon. The topic next month will be steps 4 and 5.